Well, our passage tonight again is Acts 22, and this great defense that Paul offers here before the Jewish people in Jerusalem. You recall he has been arrested, having been seen in the temple and the mistaken conclusion made that Trophimus, a Gentile, was with him, and the Jews, in uproar, caused the Romans to take him into custody. But Paul, before entering the barracks, wishes to address them. And this that we read is part of what he said. And the title of the sermon is this: Christians are not doormats. Christians are not doormats. Now, one of the reasons why the book of Acts under God was caused to be penned was this: that in part it was to disprove some of the negative views and rumours that were circulating about the Christian faith. What was this new religion that had taken root in the Roman Empire about? What did it represent? A threat to the state? Was this something that came with military strength and intention? And so there were thoughts that needed to be dispelled, the thinking of unbelievers, that these people representing this great Saviour Jesus Christ were not disruptive, divisive people, had not come to overturn the empire militarily. They were not anti-state per se. They didn't have there some sort of anarchist agenda. They weren't coming with their tents to pitch them outside some significant building in Rome and declare that they were going to come and change the whole economic system. Neither were they deceitful people, and people that were in it for money, that was the driving force in their actions and their decisions. What Paul is showing here, and Luke the writer, putting together this material, is to show, look, the church is not about criminals and fraudsters. We are not those kind of people. We have nothing to hide. We have nothing to be ashamed of. We have facts. We have evidence that is on our side for the things that we preach and the actions that we take. And so, what is being shown here? That the church, the Christian faith, is not something that poses a great threat to the Roman Empire in that way. But also that Christians are not doormats either. That it is not something that really belongs behind closed doors. That we're not, as we seem to be in our society today, where a significant minority believe. Well, what you believe stays there at the door of your building. Why, that poor man Trevor Phillips, wasn't it? The chair there of the Qualities and Human Rights Commission. And saying that, oh, these Christians, they can't think themselves above the law. If the law says that to qualify for public money, you must adhere to certain rules, if these conflict with your Christian faith, too bad. You're not above the law in the land, he says. Why, he says, are we looking for Sharia law to impose that, perhaps? And so he spoke in a rather unhelpful way there. No, we're not saying we will hear this, just quietly subside. We're not to allow these people to go unchallenged. We are not doormats. We're not a people that can just be pushed around and spoken down to and spoken ill of. And we are out to persuade people that we're not deluded, we're not mad, we're not oddballs and eccentricities, we're not emotionally deficient or some way intellectually inferior. We do not accept views that are imposed upon us, that we are subversive, that we are sort of the kinds of people might start taking up weapons like the animal rights people or something like this, some of them, or that we're child abusers, getting hold of our children, brainwashing them, telling them about six-day creation and all of these kinds of things. Neither indeed, as mentioned, are we fraudsters. The ministers are just in it for the money. that they're just in it there for the kudos, or somehow to have a platform to stand on and jump up and down like some local gauleiter. Well, no, we're not about that. Rather, we refute those views. And here, towards the end of the book of Acts, as we have these lengthy defences, apologia of Paul in different contexts, sometimes before Jewish people, another time before the Sanhedrin, on other occasions before Gentiles. This is being told, that this Christian faith is something that is reality and evidence, and that is productive not of evil but of good, has not come to bring trouble into the world but good things into the world. And so there are these defences that Paul makes, these different sermons, stroke speeches that he here addresses to different people. And in this, equally, Paul's innocence comes to the fore, that he is guilty of nothing. He has not deceived anybody. He has not stirred up violence and dissent. He is not at the head of some violent mob about to come and sack Rome. No. And indeed, the narrative suggests that it is more the opponents of the gospel, these Jews, that pose the greater threat. No, that comes through more their obstinacy and their plotting, rather than any kind of subterfuge of Paul. With him, as with the Church of Jesus Christ, it's transparent, it's straightforward. And similarly, as the evidential basis of what the church believes is to the fore, and these reports and defences are there, and Paul's innocence is being attested, we can also see in these latter chapters God's hand upon the church, that Paul is on his way to Rome, and if we were to read later on into this book, we'll find that he arrives there in interesting style, a boat in the midst of a storm breaking up, arriving on rafters there on the island of Malta. Incredible! And yes, because God's hand, as we've learnt right through this book, is upon this church, with his people. The signs, the wonders, their preaching and teaching, this supernatural visitation and guidance, indication of God's favour. Even to the extent that Paul, this man who is now going to go to Rome to be heard, could have drowned, could have sunk without trace. But God's hand is with him. Brings him safely there. And so, the book of Acts, part of its reason, is so that it can be shown to the world, look, we've nothing to hide. We've nothing to be ashamed of. We are not to melt away and leave our faith there, as the good Mr. Phillips said, at the door. Well, he said the door of the temple, didn't he, as he was just speaking about religion in general. There at the door of our chapel. No, we've nothing to hide. Nothing to be ashamed of. And rather, as with Paul, God's hand is upon us, and he is with us, and that's a bless. So, by way of introduction then, now my first heading. We are to stand up for Christ. We are to stand up for the Lord Jesus Christ. Note here, we look back over some of the other material in Acts 22, and this great defense that Paul mounts here, before this angry, baying mob of, well, righteous in their own eyes, blameless in their own eyes, Jews. And we notice various things which show that Paul is going to speak with boldness. Does that not come through? Boldness. He is going to address these people, come what may, whether they'll hear or whether they won't. And he is not going to do it as a sort of shrinking violet. He is not going to come with apology as though he were some sort of doormat there to them. But boldly, he is going to speak to them very frankly and very strongly. He's not hiding away in the barracks, not behind a phalanx of Roman soldiers there and just get me away from these people. He's going to go to them and say to them in effect, I'm not afraid of you. I've got something to say. And whatever you do, you can kill me if you like. But I'm not afraid of you. And we cast our eye back in some of the earlier material in Acts chapter 22. And see right in verse 1. Brethren and fathers, hear my defence before you now. How direct! How bold! These angry Jews, strong in their denunciation of Paul, the most hated man in the empire as far as they are concerned. And he's going to speak to them. He's going to appeal to them. Respectfully, carefully, with great grace, but he's not hiding from them. And he's calling their attention, saying to them, listen. Listen to what I am going to say. I'm not afraid of you. I'm not ashamed of the testimony I'm going to bear. I'm fully persuaded of it. And then there is that in him, a boldness in recognizing before them what he once was. You find that there in some of those verses. There is a full disclosure of who he is. He's addressing them in the Hebrew language, which in itself gains him quite a hearing. But look, he says in verse 3, I am indeed a Jew, born in Tarsus of Cilicia. So he continues. He's not disowning who he is. Oh, sometimes people do a makeover, don't they? As though what they used to be, they're completely forgotten. They don't want to address that, think about it. What they have done, they just walk away from it. As though they're not going to give any explanation or say, well, I got that badly wrong, I did. No, it's just sort of forget it and move on. But he's not. He's not denying who he is. He is not going against what once he was or airbrushing out his past. There is that full disclosure there in verse 3. Nor any disguising of the fact that he actually persecuted Christians. That's there in verses 4 and 5, how he went to Damascus there in high dudgeon to try to arrest those Christians and bring them back in chains to Jerusalem. And it's there at the end of his speech, or towards the end of it, when he talks about how they would know about him, that he imprisoned and beat those people who believed on the Lord Jesus Christ, and how he was there consenting to the death of that great martyr, Stephen. He's not saying to them, I didn't do any of that. That wasn't me. That was somebody else. He actually refers to it. He actually brings it out into the open. He declares to them boldly, that is the man that I was. That is who I was. And I thought that I was doing good. But then he goes on also, by this way of frankness and openness, not to conceal what then happened to him. Not to conceal the change. That is who I was. You notice he doesn't over-elaborate it. He doesn't exaggerate it. It is just a clear factual account. That is the man I was. And a lot of people, of course, would have known Paul. And they'd have said, yeah, that's a fair summing up of who he was. But now what's happened to him? So he explains. And he cannot hide this. I'm not going to conceal this from you. Though you may not like to hear it, though it is unpopular, this is the fact of the matter. And there he explains to them how the supernatural risen Christ appeared to him. He often refers to this, doesn't he, in these defences. This is where he takes them to the resurrection. I thought this Christ was dead. I thought that they'd stolen his body or something like that. But then I thought differently. Because I met him. He came to me and I encountered him on the way to Damascus. And that light that blinded me and that voice that came from heaven and humbled me. And I was in the dust. Proud Pharisee I was, trained at the feet of Gamaliel, the kind of man there who was strict according to our father's law and zealous in my own ignorant way toward God. And I was brought low by him. And there is a full description of that meeting, because, of course, it's pivotal. This is why I am not the man I was. This is why I am not out there with you, shouting down this religion that I once did. And he doesn't conceal either the message that this risen Christ brought to him, and all the unpalatable part of it as well. This message, which is, of course, to be for all men. As we learn in verse 15, Ananias sent to him in Damascus and tells him that you are going to be his witness to all men of what you have seen and heard. They may not like that this message is for the Gentiles, but it was there in his initial commissioning that he himself was going to be going to the Gentiles. There's no apology for this, because it was actually given by God himself. He's been sent by him. And though it be that there, in verse 21, finally, when it is the Lord himself who calls him to leave Jerusalem and go to the Gentiles, the reaction being from the crowd that they say, away with him. It's undeniable. The commission has been sent from heaven to him. The mission and outreach to the Gentiles, so loathed by the Jews, is actually of God. And he's bold to say that. He knew the reaction. He knew the nature, their feeling, and why he was held as he was. But he's going to tell them what is the scope of the love and the ministry of this risen Christ, how it reaches beyond ethnic Israel, looks to the very nations. And the day of Pentecost should have still been a lesson they had learned from and taught them that much. And it is quite provocative what he has to say. You notice how he speaks in verse 3 about being zealous towards God as you are all today. But then in verse 16, when Ananias bids him to be up and be baptized, and wash away your sins, calling on the name of the Lord. Some of that sin to be washed away was the persecuting zeal and the vigor and the anger and the way in which what now was being represented by the Jews, Paul once identified with and felt. But it had to be washed away. It was sin. It was ignorance. It was unbelief. He was a proud and an insolent man. It had to be washed away. And it had to be washed away now, not feeling zealous toward God and being a persecutor, but calling on the name of the Lord now to forgive and to wash away those things and take away its guilt and its shame. And it's provocative that the message to the Gentiles and his further instruction that this is to be his mission is heard in the temple. The very place they guarded so carefully and protected from any Gentile incursion. What was Trophimus in here? Where is he? Quick, get that Paul. How dare he defile this holy place? And in that holy place, in that very place, Paul had fallen into that trance. The Lord had spoken to him, and concluding from that, the mission to the Gentiles in the temple, in the very place that they guarded so carefully. That was provocative. That was unsettling. The very God whom they claimed would only be interested in them had spoken to Paul in their central place, most holy area, and said, go to the Gentiles. And moreover, again, it must have been lost on them this, that in verse 18, when the Lord spoke to Paul in the temple, he said to him this, make haste and get out of Jerusalem quickly, for they will not receive your testimony concerning me. And then the very thing, the testimony of Christ that Paul is now trying to bring to the people, explaining to them that the Gentiles are within now God's favor and mercy, that they will not hear. And what do they do in verse 22? They raise their voices and said, away with such a fellow from the earth, for he is not fit to live. And they hadn't heard what the Lord Jesus himself had predicted about them in what he spoke to Paul in the temple in that trance, as in verse 18, they will not receive your testimony concerning me. The hardness of their hearts. And so Paul is preaching to these people. He is standing up for Christ. He's being bold, very direct with them, speaking to them. He's not concealing what he was. He's admitting to it freely. But then he's saying, I've changed. And the reason he doesn't conceal either is because I've encountered the risen Christ. And he has turned my life around. And whereas before I used to be very strict regarding this faith, used to think it was just for the Jews and the Gentiles had no part. But now I've been told by God himself it is for the Gentiles. And all of my thoughts and my philosophy and everything that I structured my life by has collapsed. And these very things were spoken in the temple itself. Oh, that they had heard that the gospel is not there for those who think themselves righteous, but for sinners. That is intended for people that we may despise. People, classes, cultures, ethnic groups, that people to their prejudice look down upon, but God is saving amongst. The Jews looked upon the Gentiles and dismissed them, but God is working there. And oh, it shames us if we look down upon any people group amongst whom God is working. He's going to work in all of the nations. And Paul explains to them unpalatable things, not in an antagonistic way, not in a way that would have been harsh and intemperate, but yielding and pleading and earnest, but clear and direct. He's not going to be bullied by these people, though they may not like any of this, though they may not like his appeal to them, do not like the fact that he once was this but now isn't, do not like the fact that it was the risen Christ that had changed him. He's not going to be seeker-friendly. It is not unchurched Caiaphas and unchurched Anna that he is trying to reach and soothe their consciences and just speak kind words to them. He is sinner-friendly. He's telling them the truth. He's telling them what they need to hear, even about their own sin and prejudice. So we are, like Paul demonstrates here, to stand up for the Lord Jesus Christ. But secondly, running our eye again over this material, we're not to be painted as fools. We're not. We are not to be painted as fools. Paul is not going to give them the luxury of being able to think down upon him. To think, well, he's an ignoramus, this fellow. To typecast him as some weak-minded, emotional person given to these impulses, really changeable character, unstable or whatever. Paul is not going to give them the opportunity to think that, or at least if they do think it, they're going to have to be so unreasonable and going against such clear light that it will be upon their consciences to make that choice. And in effect, he pulls rank on them at different points. He's going to establish to them that he is indeed a very credible witness and a man who knows about these things very clearly and very intimately. We note there, for instance, that he was trained by Gamaliel in verse 3. He, as it were, drops that in to the defense that he is making. That he is not just anybody. That his witness is not from somebody there of great sort of backwardness and from some distant place and out there in the hills. He was trained by Gamaliel, that, well, held to be wise teacher, that man, gifted man, that man whose intellect and intelligence was really unrivaled by any. They deferred to him, remember, when it came to what they should do with the apostles. What is your thought on it? And they followed his lead. Paul had been taught by this man. You almost hear the sort of awe that his name will generate. And if you look further back, Tarsus of Cilicia, a place of culture and learning. Not a city that people sniffed at and looked down at. But if you said you came from Tarsus, immediately you would be treated with respect. You might have something to say. You were in a kind of place where learning came easy to people, where they were steeped in different literature. You were a person of standing. You were a person of quality, of stamp, and you would be liable to be heard. Oh, he's not going to allow them to paint him as being an ignoramus or a fool. And neither is he going to be a person of whom it might be said, well, you never understood the religion. You never really understood Judaism. What you have rejected, you never properly grasped. Oh, he grasped it all right. He there brings to their attention what they already knew, many of them, that it was according to the strictness of our father's law, and that he was zealous towards God, as you all are today. He knew. Taught by Gamaliel from Tarsus, strict in regard of his religion, he knew all about the Judaism that he had turned his back upon. He knew very clearly what it was that he was now building up and by implication also speaking down. He was able to assure them that this was something he knew, understood their world, where they were, what motivated them, how they looked out upon the world and made their choices and their judgments. No, he won't be painted as a fool or an ignoramus by them. He's saying to them, in effect, I know where you are. I know what you're thinking. I know what you're feeling. I know how you evaluate because I was there once myself. I knew about your world because I was in your world. And at times one hears those who adhere, culling to macroevolution and hold on to it against all evidence. And when people, scientists, leave behind its doctrines, see a better way, understand creation or intelligent design, but at least understand that macroevolution doesn't work as an explanation for life. All the vilification, these people then and their credentials are belittled. They weren't proper scientists, they weren't. If they were, they wouldn't have left behind this great faith, you might call it, of macroevolution. They wouldn't have left our great intellectual superiority, even intelligent design, that really understood science. They weren't good scientists, you see. Well, that's not true any more than it was true of Paul, that he didn't really understand Judaism, that he'd rejected something that he hadn't fully grasped. He grasped it, and he knew what he was doing. And then he also knew what had happened to him. This explanation is not the explanation of some rambling madman, not somebody who had just had a bad night's sleep and was half awake and really just not compos mentis. This isn't the idea of some kind of religious experience, some kind of ecstasy that was bubbling up within. But rather, these were objective events. This is something that happened to him from outside. This is an event that has not a fiction of his imagination or conjured up in his thinking, but which was imposed upon him by the reality of the fact that Jesus Christ had met with him. He's not going to allow them to say, well, it was a psychological state of mind that you were in, Paul, that you were just in a kind of strange place, maybe, and overcome by a strange emotion. This is very much what religion, Christian faith, is thought to be. The conversion is a strange psychological state, a kind of self-induced thing. It's music or fasting or some mysticism or some belonging togetherness that induces in us some psychological state. And Paul is saying, and we can all say in this, no, not so. That was not so. There was someone outside of ourselves who addressed us and dealt with us. And we were not as those who were imagining these things. Nothing was further from our thinking than this, that we should have been told we were sinners, and that we should have been told that the risen Christ is going to judge us. We're aghast at it. This was unexpected. And so Paul is speaking about events from outside. You can't paint me, he says, as somebody given to a rich and fertile imagination, of having a kind of diverse emotional life that quickly picks up on different things. No, I know what I saw, an objective reality, the light, the voice, the words. These were actual events. But he also would bring to their attention that another credible person attested to what had happened to Paul, Ananias. Verse 12, a devout man, according to the law, having a good testimony with all the Jews who dwelt there. He it was who came to me and stood and said to me, and then conveyed the words that the Lord had given him. Ananias, this man is not a fool. He is not somebody ill thought of, an immature person, a person of weak judgment. No, far from it. He has a good report, a good testimony with all the Jews who dwelt in Damascus. Might not agree with the faith he had espoused, but they had to say this of him. He's a good man, and he's serious, and he's credible. And it puzzles us why he says the things he says, but we treat this seriously. He is a man whom we respect. And so Paul makes that appeal, that there is Ananias. He came. He was part of all of this. He will vouch for this. And the people in Damascus will say, he's sober and credible as a witness. And there have been people in Jerusalem who would have known him as well. Paul is able to make that appeal. And we, as we give our testimony, or as we read the testimony of others, what other people say, serious-minded witnesses, people of some credibility, is not to be underestimated or not to be just dismissed. And there, the credibility of what Paul is saying, its rationality, its logic, its application, comes to the fore. Dear friends, we're not to be painted as fools. We're not to allow the world the luxury of thinking ill of us when what has happened to us is reality, what has happened to us is a matter that can be related logically, clearly, objectively, and that we haven't had some strange feeling, some warm flush, some odd tingling sensation that's run up and down our spines, but that we've actually had a coherent, rational, if supernatural, encounter with the living God. Well, thirdly this, and part again of our thinking, that we're not doormats. We're not those that are to be looked down upon by virtue of foolishness or stupid behaviour of our own part. We're not to suffer in silence. We're not. We're not called upon to suffer in silence. And we see this from the latter part of Acts chapter 22. That if Paul pulled rank upon the Jews, didn't allow himself to be painted as a fool by them, well, Paul is not going to allow the Romans either to mistreat him or to deal with him in a way that was not fitting or proper. The Roman commander, when he heard all of this shouting, all of this uproar, somewhat panicked. He wondered, what shall I do here? These people obviously are baying for this man's blood. They think he has done something appalling and abominable. I haven't a clue what it is, mind. But we're going to have to get out of an impasse here. I'm going to have to be seen to be doing something to this man to make this crowd happy. They obviously feel he's done something wrong, so I'll have to mete out some rough justice to the fella. We'll examine him and give him a good flogging in the process. It's obviously something criminal, and we're going to need to extract it from him, because no way is he going to be willing to say it. Even though Paul has already said, in effect, his piece, and has already disclosed fully what all of this matter is about. But the Roman commander thinks there must be something else to it. For this reaction here, for so many people, they can't all be in the wrong. This single fellow here, there must be a problem with him, and we're going to find out what it is. So he tries to square the circle here somehow and mete out justice, as he would consider it, to the crowd, cheer them up, make them feel happy that this miscreant is going to get his just deserts and he's going to be treated harshly by him. And at the same time there, well, think there's only one Paul, so I can hardly get too much trouble and grief coming back from him. So even if it is that there isn't really anything at the end of the day he's done wrong, he's hardly likely to complain or produce a problem for me. So if we hit him a bit, then the crowds are happy and he isn't going to come back with any retribution. So he thought. That was perhaps the strategy here. And we'll find out a little bit more about him. But Paul intervenes. And as they are about to beat him, they tied him with thongs. He speaks to the centurion in verse 25, and he asks him a question. Is it lawful for you to scourge a man who is a Roman and uncondemned? Well, there are two things in there, aren't there, to make the centurion blush a bit. The centurion probably has worked out that they don't really know what this man's done, if anything at all, and that maybe this is a bit hard to beat the poor fellow when he's just been speaking for the last however long it is to this crowd. And the crowd didn't exactly seem to be the very model of rationality while they were getting so worked up about what they were. So maybe here, the poor centurion is hearing that he's uncondemned, but if he hadn't heard that, he'd heard the other part. That Paul's a Roman? This man who this crowd hate? This man who earlier they'd mistaken for some Egyptian troublemaker? He's a Roman? They've heard him speak in Greek. That took them by surprise. Perhaps when they heard him or tried to hear him speak in Hebrew, that also took them a bit by surprise. But now to learn that he is a Roman, they're now in full panic. And the centurion quickly goes to the commander and urges him, caution here, caution, take care what you do, for this man is a Roman. And the commander then wastes no time. He's there in verse 27. Tell me, are you a Roman? Is this true? Have we taken a Roman and treated you like this? And Paul answers quite simply, yes. Yes, that is the fact. What are you going to do about it then? Well, there's the commander. And he really here kind of, as thinking out aloud, is saying, with a large sum, I obtained this citizenship. Because that's how you could in those days. If you saved up enough money, you could buy your citizenship and have all the entitlements and the freedoms that were there for the Roman citizen. Well, that was good, surely. That sounded very impressive to be able to say this. But Paul's rank again. He's not just a Roman. He was born a Roman citizen. It's thought that somewhere, maybe within Paul's family, very distinguished people, and who had conferred upon them for some particular service they might have rendered to the empire, that they and their children and their children's children should be citizens, should have the right to freedoms of a Roman citizen, which was one above having bought your citizenship. This was a higher pedigree. This was a higher up in the gold standard of what Roman citizens could be. So the commander then immediately is on the case here, and those who are about to examine him, they withdraw, and the man is released, the commander being afraid after he found out that Paul was a Roman and that he had bound him, treated him like a common criminal, a man who had, in the eyes of Roman society, a place of high standing, what, even higher than the commander himself, who'd had to pay to be a Roman citizen. Paul's rank. He isn't going to say, well, there I am. I'll just be a martyr as well. I'll go the way of Stephen, perhaps. This will atone for what I did then. There isn't some calculation like this going on with Paul. He is going to intervene. What he is about to receive, he has not deserved. They've gone against their own law. This isn't proper justice. He has done nothing that requires a beating in order to extract some confession from him. He will tell them quite happily what this is all about, if they'll listen. And so Paul does not suffer in silence. Christians are not doormats. We're not required there to receive whatever the state may want to mete out to us, whatever decisions, whatever rulings, and merely to do nothing and to say, oh, well, we'll just put up with that. Now, of course, we are taught to turn the other cheek, and certainly there are situations and cases where we would do that. If there's no choice, and we are compelled, and there's no opportunity within law to protest legally, then we may well have to turn the other cheek. Or if it's merely to do with our personal comfort, or our own personal reputation, well, they can have that, then they can have a bit more besides. Who are we? But when it is a case that is going to be, perhaps, allowing the enemies of the gospel to say, this Christian faith is a matter for criminals. Look, the Romans, they beat this fellow Paul. They wouldn't do that to somebody unless they were a criminal, you see. Paul is not going to allow unbelievers the luxury of having that. They're not going to be able to say, see, we thought he was a criminal. How the Romans there treated him, that goes to show. And this whole Christian faith, yeah, there's nothing to it. He's not going to allow that story to travel. And thus it is that he pulls rank here, and he here absents himself from this beating he's going to have, puts the Roman commander and the centurion and the entire barracks, perhaps, in a state of flummox, that they think, what have we done here? The repercussions upon us, if this man complains about us, we're in big, big trouble. Paul isn't concerned about their troubles. They can work that one out there and think perhaps more carefully the next time that they get hold of a person and think to extract something from them by beating them. So we find from this, Christians were not meant to be doormats. Pronouncements from commissions in this country, judges, politicians, we don't just listen to them politely and quietly and we say nothing. We use the law. We use the law If it is to defend the right to preach in the open air, or for Christians to practice what is conformity to their conscience in the workplace, then we will use the law. We will go. We will make our appeals. And we're glad of the Christian Institute and organizations that do precisely that. And where there are unbelievers, legislators, the media, church authorities at times, we will challenge them. And we will not allow them simply to go their way. And if it embarrasses them, and if it causes them difficulty, and if we bring to their attention irregularities in their procedures, well, so be it. That is for them to think about. There are their rules, and if we politely point out to them that they've broken them or breached them, then they will have to work out the consequences. We can use laws, complaints procedures, Freedom of Information Act, in order to, at times, yes, embarrass those who are enemies of the gospel and expose perhaps some of their plans and some of their strategies and their ways. We can petition. We can write our letters. We can be those who will have their voice heard. Not on every issue, doesn't need it. Not on every matter, some we can let pass by. But if it is that this is going to encroach upon the preaching of the word, the practice of the Christian faith in our families, in our churches, in the workplace, then on these matters, we're not going to be doormats. We're not going to suffer in silence. And with all due deference to the good Mr. Phillips, we're not simply going to leave our Christian faith at the door when we go our way after our fellowship later on and think, well, that's that, and our Christianity goes no further than that. That is to misunderstand the Christian faith entirely. But would we expect any different from the world out there? So, dear friends, some thoughts that arise from this passage, Paul's mighty sermon to these Jews and its aftermath, and how as Christians we're not to be doormats, stand up for Christ, not be painted as fools, nor suffer in silence.